From the heart of Vermont, this podcast is brought to you by Capital City Concerts, a concert series which assembles exceptional musicians from across the globe in remarkable live performances in an intimate venue. Learn more at capitalcityconcerts.org.
When I'm making an illustration, I'm definitely tapping into this deeper psychological space that is fueled by memory, by images that I see subconsciously every day, by my daily experience, by music I hear. It's kind of like walking into a grocery store, and when I'm making a piece, I pick ingredients. I start in this kind of grocery store of the mind.
My name is Karen Kevra, and you're listening to Muse Mentors, a podcast about artists and their mentors. Some people say it's not what you know, but who you know. I say it's how you know them. Full disclosure, the illustrator Armando Veve was my student when he was in high school. But he studied music with me, not visual art. Armando is a remarkable artist who draws the old-fashioned way by hand, using graphite pencils with precision, whimsy, and astounding detail and imagination. And the whole world is noticing. 2 years ago, he won a spot on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Plus, he's earned 3 gold medals from the Venerable Society of Illustrators and an ADC Young Gun Award, which recognizes the best emerging talent in the world. Stop whatever you're doing right now and Google him, Armando Veve. His website and Instagram pages have scores of his artwork, illustrations that will transport you to a world of intricate enchantment. Armando was raised in South Burlington, Vermont. He is humble, serious, smart, and quietly driven, with a laugh that is pure music. He is athletic and compact, with boyish good looks, handsome Latin dark hair and matching dark eyes, a human mashup of Ricky Ricardo, Harry Potter, and Steph Curry. I spoke with him recently from the City of Brotherly Love, where he lives and works. His lofty warehouse studio overlooks the train tracks. Armando Veve, welcome to Muse Mentors.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Hey, I spent a couple of hours last night poring over your illustrations, really getting lost in them and forgetting about politics and the pandemic and my own deadlines. They have a whimsical complexity and really a world within worlds. And it was a most welcome journey and a place I really want to return to over and over. But I want to hear about your journey. How did it all begin for you?
As a child, I grew up watching, I watched a lot of TV, and I was surrounded by books, especially books full of illustration, children's books. I would look at pictures in my in the newspapers around the house. I think the first time that I had a deep emotional connection with a work of art, I think, was when I saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I think it was just the combination of the music, the storytelling, the color, the range of character expression. There was just something about it that really connected with me, and I became fascinated by moving pictures. I became fascinated by the images I would see, and not just looking at the images, but wondering how they were made. It was this kind of mystery to me, and I just kind of followed that feeling ever since, just kind of the mystery in these pictures. And later, I would start to kind of research the makers behind the pictures. And yeah, I think it started there.
Did you, as a little kid, sit down and try to copy some of the, I don't know, cartoon characters that you saw?
Oh, yeah. I would. I started by copying. I would kind of create these kind of Frankenstein characters, heavily inspired by the images I would see, cartoons I would see on TV, but also kind of mixed with my own inventions, just being able to create an illusion of life, of something I would see from observation or in a photograph and see it come to life on paper, was an exciting feeling for me.
Do you have a portfolio of some of your really early artwork from, you know, being a really young child?
At that time, I wasn't that good about documenting the work. I wish I could see all of it, but...
How could you know?
I didn't know. my parents have kept some of my childhood sketchbooks. And when I go home, I open the boxes full of some of the older work. And it's cool to see, just revisit that mind. It's kind of, I'm kind of trying to just reaccess that kind of naive spirit. When I was making work as a child, there was a lot less doubt. I think with more experience, there's a lot more questioning.
Yeah, the innocence of childhood.
Yeah, and so it's in a way, I'm just trying to figure out how can I reaccess that way of thinking, being lighter, being more open to risk and experimentation, I think is a goal of mine.
Well, your work certainly has an amazing childlike wonder about it. It's incredibly whimsical, and the sense of curiosity is very much there. I remember the day that your artistic talent was revealed to me in a flute lesson. I don't know if you'll remember this, but you showed up one day for your weekly flute lesson, and you were a little bit late because you had been a participant in, I think it's the annual Congressional Arts Competition.
Yes,
at the
yes.
Vermont State House. Is that right?
Yeah, it was the Congressional Arts Competition.
But you came in and apologized for being a little bit late and told me why. And I said, do you have your artwork with you? Can you show it to me? And you said, sure. And you went back out to the car. Do you remember what you came in with?
At that time, it was probably a photorealistic animal.
Yes. I remember it vividly. I was blown away. It was the head of a tiger.
Oh, and, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it was so intricate and nuanced and realistic. And you said with kind of a shy smile, I won second prize. And my response was, who won first? I wanted to ask you about your name. I've always loved your name, and I've been intrigued by it. It strikes me as both majestic and energetic. Do you know anything about the derivation of your last name?
Well, first, it's nearly impossible to spell over the phone. When you're trying to say, mention it to an operator, it's a V-E-V-E. Okay, we got the first two letters. What are the next two? V-E. Okay, I got those two. But
actually, the letter V, maybe you do this as in Victory or Vermont. I have a V in my name. And
I should do V as Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Veve, actually, I was looking this up, and is actually the name of the symbols used on the Haitian voodoo flags. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, the kind of icons, these symmetrical patterns that would be used during their rituals, those are called veves, which was interesting to find out. But I'm not sure if that has any connection. My family, the veves, arrived to Puerto Rico, and they kind of inhabited the northeast of Puerto Rico. And so there's a lot of French influence there.
Interesting. I'd love for you to talk about your first mentor in art.
I think my first art mentor was actually not an art teacher, but my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Pennington. And an assignment that Mrs. Pennington gave us was to illustrate a children's book. We wrote it, we illustrated it, and it was pretty intense. Must have been like a 25-page illustrated children's book, and I covered every square inch of that book with my colored pencils.
Do you still have the book?
Yes, I look at it every time I go home. When I'm making work, I kind of think back to that book, and I think back to where my mind was. I mean, because it just seemed like the ideas kind of just poured out, and the story is cohesive. There's an arc, and it baffles me that I created something like that.
Can you give us the quick summary of the storyline?
Basically, I'm going on a fishing trip with my dad, and we are getting food for the whole family. And on our trip, we encounter monsters and beasts and obstacles, but ultimately we prevail and bring the fish home. In high school, I had some really great art teachers. They had a really great art program, teachers who really cared and really pushed you. I found that I was just hungry for more and more. And so outside of school hours, I would continue drawing. I would get my supplies at this art store in Williston, Vermont, called Artist Mediums. I loved visiting that store. Aisles and aisles of art supplies, and it was like a candy store for me. And one day I saw there was a workshop announcement. It was a nude figure drawing workshop, and for me, the ultimate artistic experience. The workshop was led by Joe Arkovich, and I had seen some of his drawings, and I was just fascinated by his technique. It was just on another level. And he worked mostly with vine charcoal and would create these incredible figure drawings with an amazing sense of anatomy. He taught this workshop, and his patience with me and his desire to help me improve has always stayed with me. He's taught me techniques that I still use to this day. When I'm using graphite, I can hear his voice. At RISD, I got an incredible conceptual education, but I think my technical education was really, really happened in that time with Joe.
Armando Veve is one of those people who is both blessed and cursed by having tremendous talent in more than one area. In high school, when he wasn't drawing, he was practicing the flute and piccolo a lot. Ultimately, he had to choose to study either music or art. One thing that's for sure is that to this day, music deeply influences his art. Look at his illustrations, and you will see the manifestation of his music training in the symphony of his artwork. You were unusual in your passion and love for the piccolo. Most flute players play a little piccolo and, you know, pretty begrudgingly. I think we should say for those who don't know that the piccolo is the little brother of the flute. It's about a third of the length of the flute, and it sounds an octave higher. The low register has been compared to
a dove with asthma and the high, right? And the high register sends most listeners running for the exits. But right. Your playing was beautiful piccolo playing. So I've got to ask, because I never did before, what drew you to the piccolo?
I love the contradiction of this small instrument that was able to overpower an entire orchestra.
Absolutely. It can cut through the full orchestra in a way that really no other instrument can.
Yeah, and I loved the size. I loved its portability. I love the instrument itself, just visually. It's almost like a piece of jewelry. It's just the mechanisms remind me of a watch. It seems like there was a lot of room still to discover new repertoire, new possibilities for kinds of music that could be made, new kinds of sounds I was still discovering.
And you very much did that. You weren't going to settle for playing the piccolo part in Stars and Stripes Forever or some of these fluffy little piccolo showcase types of pieces. And one thing I remember, you embraced a wonderful piccolo sonata by the composer Mike Maurer when you were in high school and played it to great effect and achievement. I remember you winning some competitions.
When I heard a recording of the work, I immediately fell in love with it. It was, it's virtuosic. I loved the dissonance. I loved the parts of it soared.
Oh, there's the train.
Oh yeah, here's the train. My studio is right by a train track. So that's usually the Amtrak or the New Jersey Transit. And sometimes right now it's weird because the train's mostly empty, but at night, sometimes you can see the cabins are illuminated. So from my window, I see all these people on their laptops and it's just kind of surreal. It's like these little windows into other kinds of lives.
I'm wondering if that in any way provided inspiration for your pretty recent amazing mechanical botanical drawing that you did for the MTA. There's an image where there's a plant stalk and within the plant stalk looks like a subway car.
Yeah, I think even before I was working on that poster, just being in close proximity to the train, I it's always been a point of inspiration, this kind of one, the mechanics. And right now they're actually working on the track. So there's been all these really bizarre, I've been calling them just these like insect machines. They're bright green, bright blue and yellow. And every day there's a different one parked outside my window. And it seems like they're rebuilding the track or they're doing something. But I've always been fascinated by machinery, its relationship to the human body.
And it very much shows in your artwork.
Yeah, that intersection between biology and mechanics, the artificial and the organic, the natural and the man-made, kind of the how those two worlds collide.
Do you need to know something about mechanics or anatomy to be able to draw the kinds of things that you do that are so detailed?
I think you can get away with not knowing. A big part of the making art is faking it. You kind of have to create the illusion of something that doesn't really exist. I love to really dive into the research. I think it helps me to manipulate it on the paper. It helps me to weave stories. Sometimes I might learn something about a certain subject that might open me up to other visual possibilities.
The New York Times hired you to create artwork for an op-ed about screenings for heart disorders in newborns. I'd love for you to describe that image.
Yeah, so that was actually my first editorial illustration. Essentially, they got in touch and provided this article about a new heart test. Essentially, I wanted to create an optimistic image that was hopeful, and I immediately thought of a kind of play space, a kind of a habitat for a child that was a positive image. And I took the architecture of the heart and created a kind of playground.
So there's a kind of cross-section of the heart, and it looks to me like there's a rather contemplative baby peering out from the aorta. But one of the things that made me laugh and also wonder a little bit was, why were there ladders leaning within that image?
Well, the baby had to get up there.
Here's a recitation of a short list from the long list of Armando Veve's commissioners. The New York Times, The New Yorker, Mother Jones, MTA Arts and Design, National Geographic, The New Republic, The New Scientist, Penguin Random House, Politico Europe, The Poetry Foundation, Scientific American Mind, Smithsonian Magazine, and Wired.
Who do you have advertising contracts with, or who have you had them with?
Most recently, I did a campaign for Truly Hard Seltzer. That was actually pretty epic because the project just seemed to keep growing and growing, and it actually ultimately ended in a billboard in Times Square. So that was pretty epic.
Wow. What was that image?
The series started with a kind of an underwater bubbly fantasy. So a Truly Hard Seltzer wanted to gave me they were releasing a new series of flavors. One of them was mango lemonade, and so they wanted me to kind of visualize the flavor and create images that activated the flavor cues. And so I created this kind of underwater reef with kind of mango like coral formations and squids with mango pits as brains, and ultimately it was animated and featured on a billboard in Times Square. The funny thing is that there was no one there to see it because of the pandemic.
Of course. So... Oh no.
Dear listeners, I have a favor to ask. Creating this podcast takes time, effort, and resources. I'm truly grateful for all of the enthusiasm and interest, the great reviews and ratings. I've set up a link where you can quickly and easily support the show through our Patreon page. The whole thing takes about 2 minutes. We're asking for $5 a month, but you can contribute as much or as little as you'd like. If Muse Mentors matters to you and you like what we're doing, please visit musementors.com and support us in any way you can today. Thanks.
What kinds of things have you learned about science or medicine or disease in the course of your commissions?
One that comes to mind is that we have spiders that live in our skin. That was a piece for National Geographic. They had a feature story on these microscopic spiders that live in our skin. When I say spider, you probably imagine a scary eight-legged creature, but it's really more like kind of like a tardigrade water bear slug with little arms.
Which maybe is reassuring.
Grosser. Right. It turns out that we have hundreds of thousands of these little spiders in our pores, And there's still a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not they are beneficial. But I think because they're there, they have some kind of role to play in the ecosystem of our body. And they
maybe it's a kind of deep exfoliation.
Right. I think that cleansing, they remove certain dirt and oils that might otherwise be harmful to our pores. I think they are working. They're not just hanging out.
And yet, this is a scary rabbit hole to go down because they are organisms, and organisms do things like eat and then other things later on.
And yeah. And so in my illustration, I kind of pushed that. I was thinking, what would these organisms do if they started building communities and building structures, structures like religion and exercise routines? And
this is definitely a world within worlds of artwork.
And I think it resonated because it was published when we started quarantining. And so what I didn't realize is what I had drawn was essentially a community of quarantined individuals, of socially distanced creatures.
Except, of course, for the improbably crammed together choir, little spider mites sitting in the choir loft with spider mite organist leading them. Yeah, that had me absolutely bellowing with laughter.
Yeah, the microscopic spider church. I love looking at microscopic imagery, but it kind of imagining it on a macroscopic scale, or taking a full city and putting it inside of a dewdrop. That kind of play in scale has always excited me.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about color and light. Your artwork is so radiant and colorful. Even your uncolored sketches, the black and white sketches, seem to be colorful.
Color has always been tricky for me. When I started, a lot of my work was black and white because it was hard for me to find a conceptual reason for adding color. It just seemed like color was kind of like icing on a cake. It seemed to be all sugar and no substance. And I actually preferred the look of the black and white work.
The idea of color in music is something that's very important to me. There's this kind of approach where color and sound become integrated. I know actually Jimi Hendrix was famous for that, but it's something that I think of all of the time in my teaching. And I've had students who, when we're working on a particular piece and a particular note, I'll ask for the color to be a bit more red. And I would say most of the time, they look at me like I'm crazy. But there are occasional students who really respond strongly to this. And I recall that you are one of them.
I have always considered music to be very visual. And something that I actually realized later was that I am synesthetic. I associate color with every letter of the alphabet and with every number and with every month of the year.
What color is X?
Black. Ah. It's like immediately when I see the letter, a color flashes in my head.
Cool. What color is K?
It's like a pink. It's like a weird pinky, like a puke color almost.
Well, those are my initials. How about V as in Vermont?
It's like a muted purple. It's very weird. It's very intense in my head. And sometimes when I'm reading, it can become very noisy.
Like being attacked by a rainbow.
I would love to have a fight with a rainbow. but I didn't realize that this was unusual, or I thought that everyone associated color with certain things. And some people associate smell with color, and you, I remember, always associated music with color. And I'm wondering, do you experience kind of synesthetic experiences, or is this more of a, you kind of imagine, because saying something like make the note redder makes you kind of think that you really do feel that color?
I think I come at it from a place of imagination. Maybe I've gotten to the point of synesthesia, or maybe really what we're talking about is chromesthesia, because I do react to certain notes in ways that are colored. Like for me, the note E flat is very green.
Yeah, mine's green too.
Is it? How about C sharp?
It's like a grayish yellow.
Okay, see? You have become the poster child in more than one way for RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, where you were a graduate. And you actually did the school's recent recruitment poster.
That was pretty amazing to be asked by RISD to create their latest admissions poster, which was sent out to, I think they said they made 75,000 copies that were sent out across the country.
Wow. Which
is overwhelming to know. I wanted to create an image that inspired a sense of community, that inspired, that featured a diversity of makers all coming together to create something bigger than the individual parts. I was thinking about a work in progress, kind of that idea of something that's continually evolving, which I think a student is a work in progress, and those who are lifelong students are continually evolving. And so I wanted to create something that looked as though it was in the process of becoming something else. So it's this kind of self-contained ecosystem that is forming, and also featured different platforms.
Right.
I like the idea of students developing platforms to reach new places.
I was particularly captivated by the student in the tidy whities holding the mirror up to his ear and painting an ear. You like ears.
I mean, the ear is probably my favorite body part. I think just visually, it's so complex. It's strange.
Really, you know,
it's so strange.
If you stare at someone's ear for a while, it becomes something else. Talk about world unto itself. And ears are so variable. Some people have real earlobes, others just the ear sort of connects right into their neck.
Mm-hmm. There's a complexity to the ear that is really beautiful to me. And in that image, I love the idea of RISD observational drawing is kind of core to the first year program. In the first year, you're really asked to develop a lot of drawings from observation. And I love the idea of someone using a mirror to draw their own ear, but also drawing something to a kind of magnificent scale, kind of taking the beauty of the ear, but blowing it up to become something larger than life. But also, if you look at the poster from far away, mm-hmm. it's supposed to resemble a head.
Oh, yeah. And there's the rather small brain right in the center of it.
It's developing. It's forming.
Your work reminds me some of Chris von Alsberg's, who, of course, is so well known for the Polar Express and Jumanji. It also has that wonderful, sometimes dizzying aerial view kind of perspective. I don't know if he's an influence of yours, but I wonder if you can talk about someone who is.
Yeah, I definitely love Chris von Alsberg's work. And that was actually a reason why I went to RISD. He's a RISD alum of the illustration department there.
No idea.
Yeah, and so I've always been captivated by his ideas, his ability to make us see something extraordinary from familiar things. He can take a domestic space and open up a whole world inside. I have Jumanji here in studio and Polar Express, and I look at those books often.
One of the things that's so amazing about your art is the way in which objects become characters. You literally take anthropomorphizing to an art form. There are dancing bears and dancing bugs. I saw a strand.
Dancing lamp.
Dancing lamp. I saw a strand of spaghetti become an Afghan hound. There's an egg that takes a selfie. If it were possible to see a show of hands out there in podcast land, who wants Armando to write a children's book? At just 31 years old, Armando Veve is on the path to becoming a mentor in his own right.
I'm now teaching a one drawing class amongst everything else I do. And it's made me really consider what kind of teacher I want to be. And I tried to be nurturing. I tried to make sure I listen. And I tried to leave any kind of biases I may have at the door and just really try to let the students guide the kind of community. It's probably not the case in classical music training, but technique in the arts is not as important today. I'm a very technical artist, and I love the technical side of the creative process, but for them, it's more about the ideas. It's more about the social impact of the work, how it can influence and inspire others. So it just feels different.
I think in the world of music training, technique gets more and more and more emphasized, and students become really highly skilled in their technical abilities. But I think to some degree at the expense of the music making and the heart.
Technique alone is too cold. You need the warmth of the emotion to come in. And maybe when you're talking about technique, that is in play. That technique is also how do you control the emotion. The work should have a sense of humanity. It should, I think the powerful images connect. Images that influential images are influential because they are human. There's something embedded in the iconography and the mark making that allows people to enter and to come away with some kind of insight. I think with the digital tools today, there's a possible loss of that humanity. And I think it's important, especially when I'm teaching students, to remind them that the digital tools are really attractive and they're really fun to work with, but there's nothing more alienating than an artwork made by a robot.
Right. Isn't that just like the synthesized sound of a flute in which
right.
all the colors are the same? There's just a color and there's no change in texture. It always makes me so sad, and it's so much an imposter. You know it when you hear it.
Although a synthesized flute sounds cool.
Anything you want to add? A special shout out to the piccolo player Francesco Viola for his brilliant playing of Mike Maurer's wonderful piccolo sonata included in this podcast. If you've enjoyed the Muse Mentors podcast, please help us by subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on iTunes. Until next time, find one small thing, a leaf, a stone, a drop of water, or a bird song, and look for the beauty in the small details.